This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. We may need to talk about some numbers for a few minutes, so bear with me here. In a recent survey by the Princeton Review, 82% of students said financial aid would be very or extremely necessary to pay for college. And nearly all respondents, a whopping 98%, said they would need some form of aid to fund the cost of a degree. The good news is that, yes, there are grants and scholarships and loans out there to help. The bad news is finding them can be quite a chore. That's why we invited Kalman Chaney on the show. He is the lead author for an annual guide published by the Princeton Review called Paying for College: Everything You Need to Maximize Financial Aid and Afford College. Chaney is the founder and president of Campus Consultants Incorporated, a Manhattan-based firm that has guided thousands of parents and students through the financial aid process since 1964. I asked him if there was ever a time when figuring out how to pay for college didn't require a 350-page book.
That's hard to say. And this is an important point, too, is for people who came and were educated parents in foreign countries, it's an entirely different system. Because in the United States, the primary underlying assumption is that families are primarily responsible for paying for college. The student, and if they're a younger traditional student, their parents are primarily responsible for paying for college, and that financial aid's only available if the resources of the family are not sufficient to meet the cost of attendance at the school. Whereas in many other foreign countries, you take an exam, if you get to the university, then that education is financed by the government entirely. So it's a completely different system here in the U.S. than it is in most other countries.
And when should a family begin that plan? I mean, with me, with my daughter, I started in the third trimester.
Well, you could actually even start, you know, 9 months before the baby's born, but that's a little early, but it's never too early to plan for the college, because it is going to be expensive. And part of that assumption about the family being responsible to pay is they're not looking just what can you pay out of your income, but they're assuming if your income is high enough and your other assets are sufficient, that you're going to be contributing from prior resources. That would mean money you've set aside in savings, from current income, as well as possibly future income if your income is high enough. In other words, loans.
So how much, and this is usually one of my last questions to somebody, but I've got to do this right up front. How much has COVID affected this whole process?
Okay, the COVID's made things very, very interesting in part. Things have settled down. Most schools now are having hybrid or fully in-classroom instruction. That's one thing that they're having there with the COVID. But there's also the issues of the relief, how that's going to be handled, the unemployment situation. For example, if people were unemployed in 2020 and received unemployment benefits, and more importantly, that exclusion that was granted in the Rescue Act in March of 2021, in which up to $10,200 in unemployment to an individual, up to $20,400 to a married couple filing jointly if both were unemployed, is going to be deducted from the income. That deduction of the income has certain impact with the aid process. There's also the Higher Education Emergency Relief Funds. Those are the HERF grants. Those are coming from three tranches of money, from the CARES Act, from the Consolidation Appropriations Act, and from the American Rescue Act. They're funds the schools got, some of which has to go to the students. And that's something, if you're adversely impacted, to contact the school to see about applying for those funds.
So the short answer is it's changed it an awful lot. There's an awful lot to think of.
Right. And also people's incomes may have changed. They may not have been unemployed, but their income may have been changed. Now, for students who are seeking aid for the 22-23 academic year, that, say, for example, a high school senior now that's applying for aid for next year, or students currently in college who are reapplying for aid, that's going to be based primarily on the 2020 income. Students who are currently in college now, generally they're looking at the 2019 income, but of course, with professional judgment, you can appeal that if 2020 income or 2021 income was lower, because the government grants the schools authority to do that for federal aid. And if they have their own money, the college, they can also take another 12-month period of income into account instead of that two-year prior income that's reported on the aid forms generally.
Let's talk about the big elephant in the room, the FAFSA. Is that for everybody? Should everyone fill that out? And before you answer that, just tell us what the FAFSA is.
Okay. The FAFSA is an acronym for the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. And most students, as a minimum, need to complete that application to be considered for financial aid. Now, students who are undocumented or other situations who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents, the university or the state may have separate applications to complete. For example, in New York State with the Dreamers Act, they will not complete the FAFSA form. They're not eligible for federal aid, but they can qualify for money from the state of New York. But most students who are U.S. citizens or permanent residents should be completing the FAFSA as a minimum. Now, the FAFSA, though, everybody talks about that's the most important form you have to complete. That's not necessarily true, because many schools and state governments, there are separate applications you have to complete to be considered for state aid or for institutional money. So all the forms are important, not just the FAFSA. So for example, let's say you're going to Cornell University. Well, they're gonna want the FAFSA. They're gonna want the College Board form called the CSS Profile, which is much more detailed than the FAFSA. And then they're gonna wanna see the tax returns for first year prospective students who are applying for financial aid. So it depends on the school. And that's the advice for families, is to review the website of each college to see exactly what is required to apply for aid based on your category of student. In other words, are you a first year student going early decision, or maybe early action, or early decision two, or regular decision, meaning you're a prospective student, or are you currently enrolled and you want to reapply for aid for next year? Or are you going to be transferring? Or are you a graduate student? And there are all different categories and filing requirements involved there. So it's very important you have accurate information. If you're a parent of a high school senior or a high school senior, it makes sense to make a chart to keep track of all the different moving parts that are involved. And then again, in New York State, for example, there's also the New York State aid form for the TAP program. That's the tuition assistance program. That has a separate application. That has a very late deadline, though. You can apply as late for a student who's seeking aid for the 21-22 year, even the current year. If you haven't done that yet, you could still get a grant from the state of New York, a TAP grant, because the deadline for that, the current academic year for kids who are in college this year, if you're a New York resident going to school in New York State, or you were educated in high school for a couple of years, graduated from that high school and are going to college in New York State, even if you're out of state or you're an undocumented, you can get that TAP grant as long as you apply by June 30th of 2022. So there's still several months to go. New York State is one of the latest deadlines to apply for state aid. Other states, though, may have earlier deadlines. For example, if someone's listening to this in Vermont, Vermont awards their state aid on a funds available basis. So if you're applying for aid for the 22-23 year, getting that FAFSA in sooner rather than later could set you up to get that money from the Vermont Higher Education Authority in the state.
Off the top of your head, how's Massachusetts?
Massachusetts, they have a deadline. It's going to be sometime in the spring. I'm not sure exactly. It used to be May 1st to have the application processed by that date. But it is not one of the states that awards funds on a funds available basis as Vermont does. So every school calls the shots. This is not a centralized process like the IRS. People will say FAFSA didn't give me any money. That's a warning sign if somebody says that they don't understand anything at all about how the aid process works, because FAFSA is just the form. So think of FAFSA as Form 1040, the IRS return. It's not an agency that awards money. You list on the schools what information you, which schools you want to get your information, and then they forward it to the school. And then the school has to follow the 14,000 pages of federal regulations toward their own money. And then they also can have their own policies and procedures toward their own funds. Most people think the primary function of the aid office is to award students money. But the reality is, its most important job function in the aid office is to maintain compliance with all those federal regulations. Because if they don't, and they have a program review, they can get fined millions of dollars, which has happened in some cases up to that amount. Sometimes even the record's about 17 million, I think, one school got a fine. But more importantly, the school can lose their eligibility to participate in federal aid programs. And if that happens like that, funds are no longer going to be there from the federal government, no federal loans, and the school will shortly be closing its doors. So it's very important to realize that this is a very regulated process, and you need to know what you're doing because there's so many rules and regulations in play.
Still to come, our conversation with Cal Cheney continues with a look at FAFSA simplification. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Cal Cheney, an expert in college financial aid and lead author of the book, Paying for College, Everything You Need to Maximize Financial Aid at a Ford College. Recently, something called FAFSA simplification has been passed. So has that helped?
So FAFSA simplification, as the Department of Education has told the colleges, does not mean it's going to be easy. And FAFSA simplification is legislation that was part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act of December that was passed. Now, some provisions have already gone into effect with simplification. Specifically, male students 18 to 25 no longer need to be registered for selective service to qualify for federal student aid, nor do students who were convicted of drug offenses while they're receiving federal aid, they will still be eligible for that assistance. So even though those questions are asked on the 22-23 FAFSA, the responses to those questions aren't going to affect a student's eligibility for assistance. The big part of those simplification is going to be the changes in how eligibility for federal student aid is going to be determined. They're removing a number of questions. Many colleges are not happy about that. So most likely when those provisions go into effect, more schools are going to require forms in addition to the FAFSA form when they're awarding their own institutional aid funds. There's also going to be problems for some families. The two notable provisions are they're redefining who is the parent who has to put their information on the FAFSA form for a dependent student if that student's parents are not living together anymore. In other words, if the biological adopted parents are living apart, under the current rules, they will define that parent who has to report their information on the FAFSA form as the parent with whom the child spent the most time 12 months before that FAFSA form is filed for that academic year. The new rules are going to be who provides the greater amount of support, which still really hasn't been defined. That's all the law says. But some in the aid community are thinking it's going to be going on who claims the child on the taxes. Now, because they're looking back 2 years, this is something for families to be aware of. Yes, those rules may not go into effect till the 23-24 or more likely even the 24-25 academic year. But because there's a 2-year look back period with the income, for 2023-2024, it's going to be based on the 2021 taxes. So those parents who were separated may want to keep on top of this, because if those rules go into effect for 22-23 in terms of who is going to decide to claim the child on the tax returns if they're living apart as a dependent, if that's what they're going to go with. And one of the benefits of the book we have is we have an update service, so we keep people apprised of changes happening. But the government's too busy now with HRF and other issues, and the current rollout of the new aid form and the new aid system, the website's been reworked to be worrying about 23, 24, 24, 25. The Department of Ed's already requested an extension to 24, 25 to change those provisions because of technology issues involved with the law as well. But Congress is going to have to approve that. So the department can't say we're going to do it for sure, but they're waiting on Congress. They've requested that. It's going to be a heavy lift for the Department of Education to pull this off for the 23-24, but that's going to happen. But regardless of that, one needs to be careful. Also, too, the multiple student adjustment is ending. Currently in the federal methodology, the federal aid formula that's being used to award aid, there's more than one dependent in the household in college concurrently in the same academic year. They will chop that parent contribution that's calculated in half. If there are three in school, they'll chop it in thirds each. So that significantly increases eligibility for aid in the formulas.
That sounds like a huge change.
That's a huge difference. Now, the schools are going to have discretion to take that into account. But as every college knows, if you do too many adjustments to the data and certify students for more aid based on this process known as professional judgment, that increases the likelihood the school be subjected for a program review, which is a five-alarm fire for any aid office because the government auditors are going to come in. And with 14,000 pages of regulations, they're going to find something you are not doing. The worst case situation is the school might lose their eligibility for federal aid and be out of business.
If you're to walk into any average college class in the country with 25 students there, are all 25 of them paying different prices for to be in that class?
Okay, I wouldn't say the average class size is 25 students.
No, of course. I just picked a number out.
But it's like going on an airplane, yes. And maybe there are 25 passengers and the plane is a quarter full, or maybe there are 100 passengers and it's a capacity, or there's more. People are paying different rates. So higher education is very much a discounting industry. And they even talk about that industry, the amount of discounting that's going on. It's important to understand, though, with the aid from the college's perspective as opposed to the families. If, say, you're in New York, and you're getting a Pell Grant of $5,000, and you're getting a $5,000 grant from the state of New York, you're getting $10,000 in grant money, other people's money. As far as the college is concerned, when that money comes into the university, that's the same as if mom, dad, or John or Mary paid the money to the school out of their own pocket, because that's not reducing the revenue coming into the school. Mm-hmm. They're still getting that money coming in. It's just coming from somebody else. As a parent, you're viewing this as a discount, what I have to pay. But as the college is concerned, that's not any reduction in revenue. And their own money, though, that they give out, that is a reduction in revenue. If they're giving out merit money, if they're giving out need-based grants or scholarships from their own coffers out of the university, they're taking a cut on the revenue that's coming in. And that's why it's important to remember the three R's of higher education: revenue, rankings, and ratings. And that's what drives the whole higher education industry, because the revenue per student that they receive is crucial, because that affects in part the U.S. News and World Report rankings. It's a big impact. In fact, 52% of the U.S. News and World Report rankings are based on monetary issues. How much do they pay the faculty? What percentage of the alumni donate money to the school? How many students are on Pell Grants? How much revenue is received per student? And other factors as well, because the money also impacts the retention rates. Besides those rankings, though, there are the ratings, Moody's and Fitch, the bond ratings. So if a university wants to build a new dormitory, they perhaps have to go into the bond markets to raise the money to do that. And those bond ratings look at how much revenue is coming in per student, among other things. So the three R's of higher education are very, very important. If you work in a university, after a few months, you realize it's not everything's all about the students, it's all about the money. They don't work the same way as public high schools and elementary schools do. They're still tuition charging institutions. So that doesn't mean they're bad people, but you have to realize they're not charities. And because of the demand rate exceeds the supply, the majority of private colleges and a large number of state schools now engage in financial aid leveraging. That is, they're trying to determine what's the least amount of aid they need to give you and still get your child to enroll in the university. That's why we say, for example, you have to look at the college aid office the same way as you look at the IRS. They're not working for you. Remember, their employers are writing for the checks for those employees in the aid office. That doesn't mean they're bad people, but institutional constraints and enrollment goals and financial aid leveraging and enrollment management is going to in part influence how much money you get. And that's why you need to be a savvy consumer.
If you started and contributed and have a nice little nest egg built up in a 529 plan, does that affect your eligibility for aid?
Okay, that's a very good question. And that depends on your circumstances and the programs you're going for as well. So 529 plans, that refers to the section of the IRS tax code that allowed states and some other organizations to offer these plans where people can save money toward their own college or toward relatives' colleges. And the money is deposited on a federal standpoint with after-tax dollars. You don't get a deduction for the contribution, but the benefit of the 529 plan is that any buildup in value in a 529 savings plan is going to be free of federal taxes when the funds are withdrawn, provided they're used for qualified higher education expenses, meaning tuition fees, room and board, et cetera. Now, they changed the law about that and said now you can use up to $10,000 even for private school. But if you live in New York, understand they will impose taxes and penalties on those distributions if you're using them for pre-K through 12th grade. So generally speaking, you should not be using a 529 plan to pay for prep school or younger child's private elementary or middle school, or even pre-K or kindergarten. So you should be used for college because then you get the federal and the state benefits in New York. Whether that affects the aid is going to depend what programs you're eligible for and also the formulas. Now, the federal formula looks at assets for most people who file the returns, but for people who are low income, meaning a parent of a dependent student or an independent student, if they've got a adjusted gross income under $50,000 and meet other criteria, for example, maybe they're on a federal means-tested benefit program such as SNAP, which is food stamps, or Medicaid, or a federal reduced price lunch program at school, or some other things. In those cases, they don't look at the assets at all. So the federal formula is not going to consider the asset. 529s, though, when I do presentations to parents, I'll always say, how many of you have 529 plans? And then I'll clarify it and say, well, and how many of your students have 529 plans? And invariably, people all raise their hands saying their children have 529 plans. But the reality is most children don't have 529 plans. Even though you have one, you're wondering, what is he saying? That's not true. Because in most cases, when you look at the plan, it's going to name an adult, FBO, and then the student. FBO stands for benefit of. So in those cases, the parent owns the plan. And those are going to be treated the same way as any other assets you have in plain vanilla accounts, cash in the bank, stocks, bonds, mutual funds that are not in retirement accounts. Assets also, too, if they're assessed, are not assessed nearly as heavily as income is being assessed in the formulas. So having those plans, as we say in the beginning of the book, having that money is a lot better than not having it because most schools don't meet need in full. They don't have enough aid to go around. So that's something, even when your child's wise, to be setting those plans up, putting it in there, not viewing, well, if I just don't have it at all, I'll get a lot more aid. That's not necessarily the case. You're going to be a lot better off. Yes, the aid may be reduced a bit in some cases.
Kalman Chaney is one of the nation's leading experts on college financial aid. The name of his book is Paying for College, Everything You Need to Maximize Financial Aid and Afford College. It's published by the Princeton Review. Paying for college can have even more roadblocks for undocumented students. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Access to college is a big step for undocumented students. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Alessandra Basso-Vienrich explores the problems they face in this quest.
When in 2013, I interviewed Mario, a college student who grew up undocumented in North Carolina. I asked him what he thought about the fact that the state does not offer in-state tuition to undocumented students. 8 years later, his answer still resonates with me because it captures the sentiment shared by most of the college students that I interviewed in North Carolina and Massachusetts, two states that, along with 27 others, do not offer in-state tuition or financial aid to undocumented students. In the interview, Mario said to me, "I know without a doubt that I deserve to be in a place where I can increase my potential to the point that I can use my abilities to do some type of good." Like Mario, the students I interviewed had grown up undocumented, and like many other undocumented college students, even though they had benefited from Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, were frustrated by their difficulties accessing college in these states as a result of the high cost of tuition and inability to receive state and federal financial aid. In my research, I focus on the approximately 454,000 undocumented students that each year go to college and found that despite similarly restrictive tuition policy context for undocumented students in North Carolina and Massachusetts, the experiences of undocumented students, as well as their understandings of higher education in these two states, differed. I attribute this to a set of local and state-level factors, such as histories of migration, divergent policies and practices towards immigrants, and immigrant population demographics. I conclude that these factors decentralize the role of tuition policies at the state level, and I caution scholars and practitioners against generalizations about undocumented students' educational experiences from state to state.
That was Alessandro Bazo Vienrich of Worcester State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.